1, 2, 3. All right. Good afternoon, everybody. It's Sunday. I guess it's pretty early morning if you're on the West Coast, and it's midday if you are on the East Coast. Here in London, it is 5:05 in the afternoon, and we're doing another show live from London. It's a, I guess this is a treat. Now, let me just. Somebody asked me if I slept well last night. Yeah, I mean, man, I was so tired. I think I slept like 11, 12 hours straight. I mean, I'd been accumulating all this tiredness from my camp. Got to the hotel at 2:30 in the morning. Didn't sleep that many hours. Then another flight. Slept on the plane. Didn't sleep any hours. So yesterday, it all came together, and I got a good solid, way more than I usually ever years of sleep. So still tired though. It's all that flying. It drains you. All right. Let's see what I want to talk about today. And I just spent a couple of hours, maybe 3 hours, at the National Gallery here in London, which is like 5 minute walk from my hotel. And I often go to the National Gallery. In recent years, I've often gone to the Tate British, not the Tate Modern. And I love the Tate Modern, the Tate British. I hate the Tate Modern. I love the Tate British. But today, I decided to go to the National Gallery. And it was great, particularly in the context of the discussion we're having and had with Douglas Murray about Western civilization and what it is and kind of the historical scope of Western civilization. Because what I basically did is at the National Gallery, and it's a great museum because you can do this. You can do it in 2, 3 hours. You can do the whole museum. It's not massive. And particularly if you know what you like, I've been to the museum many times. So I know what I like. And what you get is a complete survey of the history of Western painting, at least. There are no sculptures, it's just painting, from pre-Renaissance all the way to the 19th century. Luckily, I don't need a survey of 20th century Western painting. But so you get this amazing overview, and if you do it in order, that is, if you start with pre-Renaissance, and you go from gallery to gallery in the order in which it's arranged, which is an historical order, you actually get this amazing survey of Western art. And if you know a little bit about anywhere near enough about the history of Europe, and I should know a lot more, and it's a real regret of mine that I don't know much more. But if you know Western history, you can integrate what you're seeing on the wall with what is going on in the West historically. And it truly is fascinating, or at least it is fascinating for me. And I think for anybody who is interested in civilization, it also connects to this whole idea of spiritual values and how one can gain spiritual values without religion, because it's so much fun and it's so invigorating and stimulating and interesting and spiritually satisfying to see all these paintings. Not all of them. Some of them are boring. A lot of them are boring. But the wow, I mean, it's just quite amazing and quite fascinating. So what I thought I'd do, at least to start us off here today, and of course I'm always available to take super chat questions, is give you my kind of survey and a little bit of my input into kind of the history of Western art, the connection of that to Western civilization. And all right, and the connection to to what we were talking about yesterday, to the connection with religion. Now, I don't know. I just got a message here that the internet is slow and it's going to downgrade the quality of the videos. Hopefully it's not too bad. If you can let me know on the chat on Facebook or on YouTube, then if the video quality deteriorates so badly that I need to stop, I'll do that. People asking why I'm in London. I'm in London because I did an event on Friday, with Douglas Murray on Who is Killing Western Civilization. And I'm going to spend the next 2 days, Monday and Tuesday, meeting with financiers and raising money for my hedge fund. I then fly to Switzerland. I'll spend 3 days in Switzerland, 2 days, a day and a half in Geneva, and a day and a half in Zurich. Again, meeting with financiers, raising money for my hedge fund. So that's kind of my schedule. I then go to, then I'm going to go to Barcelona for fun, and then I will go to the Canary Islands for a conference. I can talk more about that. I'll probably do a show from the Canary Islands. I'll talk more about that conference when I do that show. And then I'll do an event in Paris. So in 2 weeks from yesterday, we will have a day-long event in Paris, or a half-day event in Paris on Who is Ayn Rand? I can't say that in French, but most of the speakers will be in French. And I will be speaking there. So that's kind of my schedule over the next 2 weeks, but it's why I'm in London. And, you know, again, the National Gallery is just around the corner here. It's 5 minutes away from my hotel. So it's if you're in London, I mean, let me just say this. If you travel, wherever you travel, whenever you travel, and you have a couple of hours to spare, try to go to the museum in the city you're traveling in. So make an effort to go and museum. And yeah, in the beginning, you won't understand it, it'd be boring. And if you're just beginning in art, then get the headphones and get the explanations and just go through museum and don't obsess about, just try to figure out what you like and what you don't like. You know, try to listen to everything, because it's always good to get an historical perspective on these things. But you know, try to get a sense of the history and the art and what the commentator at least is saying about each painting and the context in which it was painted. But focus primarily not just on what you're hearing, because I think what you're hearing is important and to give you a perspective, but on what do I like and what don't I like? Which paintings do I like and which paintings don't I like? And try to figure out why you like some paintings and why you don't like others. I mean, that's kind of the next step. But as you do this, you'll refine your own sense of art, because you'll be listening to explanations. You'll gain a sense of the history of art and what to look at in art, because just because you like something and don't like something now doesn't mean you'll like the same thing or dislike the same thing 5 years from now. You gain more knowledge, and as you know, more context. So keep gaining the knowledge and the context about the history of art, about the context, about the painters, about everything. But also about your own values. So what do I like about this painting? What don't I like this painting? Why am I attracted? Because I find I can go into a gallery now, scan it quickly, and find one or two pieces and just go right to them, because they're the ones that interest me. They're the ones that I'm attracted to. And it's always interesting to say, why? Well, what is it about this painting? Because there are like 20 paintings here and I chose this one. Why did I choose this one? And it's, you know, it's a lot of fun. And as you understand this, as you understand this more and more and more, you will gain spiritually more and more and more from the experience of viewing the art, of evaluating the art, of and at some point, you know, I can go into the Louvre or into a massive museum. The National Gallery is not that big, but I can go into a massive museum. And I can just go for the stuff I like, and I just go experience it. Yes. And you know, I walk out and I'm done, right? Because I don't have a lot of time or something like that. And then once in a while, like today, because I've got Western civilization on my mind, I can go in and do a survey and get like, oh, okay, yeah, what I said about Western civilization, Western art, this connects. Look, here's the secular, here's the religious, here's the transition between the secular to the religious. Here's a religious painting, but it's really secular in these ways. And it truly is fascinating as a consequence, and it truly is interesting. But again, many times I go to, and this is why you should go, every city, almost every city, even in the U.S., and particularly cities that have a history into the 19th century, and every city in Europe, certainly every city in Europe, have a good museum, have at least one good museum. Avoid the modern art museum, We can talk about that. It's complete garbage. But, you know, focus on the older, the traditional museums, the old museums, and just go visit. Go visit everywhere. I mean, Copenhagen has some amazing museums. London has the National Gallery and the Tate, not the Tate Modern, the Tate Britain. Sweden has a good museum. Every city in Germany basically has a good museum. France, of course, wow. Every little village sometimes has a great museum. And just experience it. Learn about your own taste in art. Learn about what stimulates you, what gets you excited, what you love, what you hate. Really be selfish about it. But also use it as an experience to educate yourself about history, about art, about your own values, about what gets you excited. So it really is cool. Somebody says there's a lot of politics drive sometimes these exhibits. A lot of the time that's not true in the older museums, in the more traditional classical museums. Like, there was no politics in the National Gallery. There was nothing political about the display. It was by period. It was the artists that I know, the artists that I would expect to be up on the wall, the great artists of each period. And I would just, even if they're trying to push a political agenda, just ignore it. Ignore the political agenda. Focus on the paintings. Particularly if it's historical. If it's historic, there's always something to focus on. There's always something worthwhile. There's always something of value to do it. Now, I know I asked for Super Chat questions, and go ahead and ask the questions, but I am going to delay answering any question that's not related to the topic, because otherwise, if I get distracted now and go into politics, which is what you guys want to talk about, I guess, or Brandon at least wants to talk about, then it's going to be hard to transition back to the topic at hand. What I'm going to do is I'm just going to leave that to the end. If you want to ask me anything about art, about London, about the or about history or about art history or anything like that, go ahead. Now, let me just say in advance, I am not an art historian. I'm not an expert in aesthetics. I probably know more than most people. I probably know more than most objectivists. I probably know more than most people just generally. But I've spent time and energy and focus, and I've lectured on it, but I'm not an expert. So I'll give you my sense of it, but please don't view this as a definitive word. Somebody's asking just quickly, did Ayn Rand have a favorite painting? I'll answer that even though it wasn't a Super Chat question. And if you're on Facebook, just go to YouTube and you can ask questions there using Super Chat. But I don't know that she had a favorite painting, but she had, I can mention two favorite artists of hers. First was Vermeer. I saw two of his paintings at the National Gallery. It's worth going to the National Gallery just to see the Vermeers they have. They have two, which is very unusual, because there's so few Vermeers in the world that a few museums have more than one, or a few museums have any. And when they do, they usually have one, but the National Gallery does have two. Now, my favorite Vermeers, I have to say, the two that they have, but still beautiful and still reflective of the power and the uniqueness of Vermeer. So she loved Vermeer, and she loved Cappelletti. Cappelletti was a contemporary of hers. Cappelletti painted in the middle part of the 20th century. Stylistically, I'd say technique-wise, he was somewhat similar to Dali, but with much better themes than Dali. He wasn't a surrealist. He was much more of a realist, romantic painter. Beautiful stuff, beautiful paintings. There are some Cappellettis. There's probably, I don't know, 3, 4, 5. They were, at least. I don't know if they're still there. On display at the Ayn Rand Institute, of all places. Not accidentally, because Ayn Rand owned quite a few. And then a number of Ayn Rand fans have collected Cappelletti over the years. And one of them, who is a board member at the Institute, the former CEO, Jim Brown, owns a few, and he put them up on display at the Institute recently. One of my favorite paintings of all time, it's called Desnudo, the nude, which Ayn Rand owned and was hanging supposedly hanging in an apartment in New York. And then And then Leonard Peikoff had it, and it was hanging in his house, and now it's at the Ayn Rand Institute archives, and now it's on the wall at the Ayn Rand Institute. Is just, it's one of my favorite paintings of all time. Years ago, I got permission from Leonard to make photographs of Desnudo. Some of you might have copies because you bought them from me. I sold reproductions of it on photographic paper. I don't think there are many. There weren't many of them, so there were a few. If you own that, it's a unique print. There are not a lot of people in the world have that. I have one at home, and I love it. It's just a magnificent painting. I know a lot of women who hate it because it's and I know why Ayn Rand liked it, because I think it's a painting. It's a woman, a female nude. She's on her knees. Looking a very strong. I mean, her features almost look like Ayn Rand. She's got those piercing eyes, those dark eyes, piercing eyes, looking straight at you, a little bit up. She's on her knees with her hands behind her back. And it reminds me of the way Ayn Rand defines femininity. The strength, the power, but the hero worship. She's got that look on her face. She's got that tilt a little bit upwards, like she's looking up at a hero. And it's just magnificent and inspiring and a truly beautiful, beautiful painting. Very sharp, very clear features, beautiful, beautiful female body, and it's gorgeous. That's one of my favorites, although, I know a lot of people who don't like it because she looks, I guess for them, she looks too submissive. To me, she looks so powerful, and yet, hero worshiping in the sense that she's on her knees looking up, hands behind her back. So there's a certain submissive that they're combined with immense power and immense strength and immense intelligence in those eyes. So, take that for what it is. That's one of my favorite paintings, one of Ayn Rand's favorite paintings, given that she had it in her home. I don't know where you're going to find it. I think I have the only photograph of it. I have the negative somewhere. Who knows? Maybe one day I'll produce more, maybe take a photograph of the one in the archives and produce more. But I don't know. It's probably in a book of Cappelletti art. If you look for Cappelletti and you look for art, then you can probably find it. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous painting. Let's see. And of course, if you visit the Ayn Rand Institute, which you should, then you can find it at the Ayn Rand Institute hanging on the wall. So let's do this. So what I wanted to do is to give you my overview as a consequence of kind of my reflections on my tour of the National Gallery, of kind of the history of Western art, the connection between the history of Western art and what I discussed about Western civilization with Douglas Murray. And I encourage everybody to go watch the Douglas Murray discussion. It'll be up on my YouTube channel. I expect later today. We tried to get it up earlier yesterday, but there was some bandwidth problems about getting it up. So hopefully it'll be up later today. If not, you can watch it on the Ayn Rand Institute website YouTube channel. But it was a good discussion, and I encourage you to go and watch that. And that was the Douglas Murray Yes, and those of you who are from London or Europe, in November 21st, I think it is. November, no, it can't be 21st. Anyway, in November, can't remember the date, I'm doing an event with Brandon O'Neill that's going to be start to be advertised very soon. So, Annie might post that in a minute on Facebook, or maybe, that's going to be a lot of fun. So hopefully you can come to that as well. All right, so it's fascinating. You go into any museum with a history of art, and you almost always start with the art of the pre-Renaissance, and it's boring. And usually I go very quickly through it. I want to see it because it gives me that historical context. It gives me that context from which I can then appreciate everything else. Everything's flat. You can see immediately that the paintings have no perspective. And the reason they don't have any perspective is they don't know perspective. There's no concept of perspective, really. And they're flat. They're all religious. All religious. Almost all the paintings of Jesus or Mary or some saint. Flat, unlifelike, you know, wooden characters that are really boring. Sometimes the more interesting ones, they try to bring out a lot of color. They're trying, particularly later, if you start getting into the 14th century, more color, more vibrancy. They're trying to attract you. Europe is starting to wake up. But generally, what you get is nothingness, is boredom, and primitivism. And this is, of course, reflective of European history during that time. It's dominated by the church. It's dominated by religion. The idea of studying nature and looking at nature and depicting nature is viewed negatively. Nature is not where anybody spiritual looks to. If you're spiritual, you look to the heavens, you look to the skies, you look to scripture. You're not supposed to study from reality. You're not supposed to. There's no anatomy. The figures are wooden figures with no muscles, no musculature, because you're not supposed to have models. You're not supposed to study from reality. You're supposed to just contemplate the universe and, you know, just depict the stories of the scriptures out of your imagination. And if you don't study the world as an artist, if you don't study the human body as an artist, you can't depict it. Your inner eye, whatever the hell that is not going to give you the information that is necessary in order to effectively describe or paint, draw, sculpt the world around you. So there's no anatomy. The trees don't really look like trees. There's no perspective, as I said. They don't know the science of perspective, but they're not even trying. They're not even trying. So European art of this period is primitive and dull and uninteresting and unspecial. And then you slowly start to see a progression, a beginning of the differences in the 15th century with the beginning of the Renaissance. And what is happening during that period? What happens is that Thomas Aquinas and primarily Aquinas, he is the genius who initiates this, and then other figures pick this up, starts exploring the works of Aristotle. And as a consequence of exploring the works of Aristotle, gain a deep appreciation for human reason, and in a particular scope of life, an appreciation of the world, this world. So the focus shifts from just the otherworldly, just from the spiritual, so-called spiritual world, just from the world of religion and the world of the books, to reality. There starts to be a focus on reality. There starts to be discussion about happiness. There starts to be discussion about how the world works. There starts to be a beginnings, the very beginnings of scientific exploration. There starts, you know, the first economists, the scholastics in the 16th century in Spain. In the Catholic world, this idea of reason starts permeating through. And as a consequence, there starts to be interest in the world out there. There starts to be interest by artists in anatomy and in how a tree really looks, and then ultimately in what is perspective and how do you create it in a painting? How do you take a two-dimensional space and turn it into a three-dimensional world? How do you depict three dimensionalities? a third dimension, right? A three-dimensional world in a two-dimensional space. And in sculpture, there starts to be interest in the human form. Or even if they're sculpting animals, in what is an actual animal form? And they start using models. And later on, Michelangelo, in secret, without anybody knowing, actually goes to the morgue and starts opening up bodies to study their anatomy, to study the muscles, to study the bone structure, to refine his knowledge. And he has to do it in secret because he's caught He could easily be killed because it is illegal to cut up a dead body. I mean, imagine what that does to science, to medicine. And it's only starting in the Renaissance when you could start cutting up bodies that art advances and medicine advances. Because suddenly they discover, you know, what's going on inside for hundreds of years. In the West, at least, in the Arab world is more advanced during part of this period, but in the West, at least, there's no knowledge of the human anatomy. And therefore, there's no such thing as medicine. There's no such thing as a science of science at all. And of course, there's no such thing as art in any kind of meaningful way. So you start seeing in the paintings as you walk through the galleries, better anatomy. Jesus now looks like a human being. It doesn't look like something cut out of a newspaper, you know, a two-dimensional flat thing. But he starts having three dimensions. He starts having a body. They start seeing scenery that is not just flat, but has perspective, has depth. Muscles, the muscles themselves gain three-dimensionality. You start seeing volume. And slowly you see the focus of the artist shifting from the otherworldly to this world. You start seeing in painting the secularization of the Western world. The secularization of the Western world. Hey, Annie just posted on Facebook a link to Desnudo of Cappelletti. I don't know where she got it from, but Annie's great. Let me post it on YouTube for those of you on YouTube. There you go. Oh, it's from Paper Tiger. Let me just click on that because I'm curious. Yeah, my guess is that's a photograph of my photograph. Not my photograph. My wife took the photo. I shouldn't take credit for stuff I didn't do. As Roberto Shevsky from Brazil, an objectivist from Brazil, points out, perspective came into painting and architecture with Brunelleschi. I got it right. Brunelleschi in 1415. But even there, it comes in initially and it develops, and you can see it in the painting developing because the science of how to exactly do it develops until you get to the 16th century and you see particularly in Nordic arts, in Flemish art, you see these cathedrals and the complexity of the architecture. And they're just showing off. They're showing off their ability to create perspective and with the architecture and everything. It's just stunningly amazing and beautiful, 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 beautiful. Yeah, there might be something, yeah, with a link. I play around with the link. It'll work. There might be something at the end of it that doesn't quite work. But if you remove the last word in the link, you can make it work for those of you on YouTube. And I'll try to put the link in the description underneath. And by the way, it's not a great photograph. It's small. The colors are a little bit off, but you get the sense of the. Hopefully, you get the sense of the painting from the image from the link. It's much, much better. Much, much, much better in reality. She's much more alive. The tones of the flesh are much more alive. Here, you know, she's not. Here, she looks a little ugly. She's not ugly at all in the painting itself. But you can see the shapeliness. You can see the sexuality. You can see that hopefully in the eyes, the look, the sharpness, the alertness. And you can see, if you blow it up a little bit, those Ayn Rand eyes there and a little bit of the hair. It looks a little bit. Anyway. As you walk through the galleries, you can really see it, right? You can see even before 1415, you can see them experimenting. You can see them trying. You can see them giving it a little bit. But once 1415 comes, it's just there's an explosion of art during that period. And now everything's rounded, everything's real. The colors become more vibrant. You get perspective, so you get scenery in the background. The images become more powerful, more robust, more human, and more heroic. Jesus looks like a muscular young man as compared to the emaciated, pathetic, you know, suffering, gloomy Jesus of everything else. But it's not just Jesus. Mary looks like a woman and the saints are saints. And of course, the paintings are still all religious. There are almost no secular paintings at this point. Although we'll get to, I want to say something about Michelangelo in this context. But Most of the paintings are still religious scenery. They're basically the same themes as you can see in the pre-Renaissance paintings. The same stories, not necessarily themes, but the same stories depicted. But now, much more interesting, much more exciting, much more dramatic, much more alive. One of the great masterpieces that are at the National Gallery is a Leonardo da Vinci, Virgin by the Rocks or something like that. I forget the exact name of it. And you can see why Leonardo is considered the genius that he is. I mean, the figures are alive. They've got three dimensionals. The scenery is dramatic. The lighting is powerful. Little Jesus and something. Madonna by the Rocks, it's called. That's right. And it's all so engaging. Your eyes goes directly to it. You can immediately separate it from everything else on the wall. It is distinct. It is special. It is incredibly powerful. And you can see his genius in recreating reality. Now, again, the theme is religious, and the story is a religious story. But the themes are not necessarily religious. That is, the theme, the message that you're getting from the painting is not necessarily a religious message, even though the story is a religious story, because what you're seeing, to some extent, you're seeing amazing beauty. Beautiful people engaged in beautiful acts, even though you know this is Jesus, or this is Mary, or whatever, the saints, or whatever. So it's interesting. So the Renaissance continues in this religious theme, although, and I mentioned this a little bit yesterday, note that Michelangelo's greatest achievement, Michelangelo's first sculpture, and you know, maybe greatest achievement, is the David. And the David, of course, is from Jewish history, but there's nothing religious about the sculpture. This sculpture is completely secular. And I think what you see during the Renaissance is many artists are flirting with the secular. Many artists are trying it out. And there are periods in which the church is lax and allows them to get away with it. And then there are other periods in which the church shuts them down and prevents them and penalizes them. And that's very much reflected in the life of Michelangelo himself. He can do a David. And there is a riot in Florence because the David, wow, the David is Greek. He's not Christian. It's this beautiful, masculine, amazing man, young man. The muscles are gorgeous. He's just an epitome of heroism and determination. He is in this world. He's not in some other world. He's not inspired by God. There's no mystical element to the paint, to the sculpture at all. This, unfortunately, is not in the National Gallery. You'll have to go to the Accademia in Florence to see this. But it is a must. It is a must to go see Michelangelo's David. It is one of the great experiences in life. I try to go to Florence every few years. And when I go to Florence, I go to the Accademia and just spend an hour just contemplating Michelangelo's David. It is such a visceral, emotional, spiritually enlightening experience. The courage, the determination, the intelligence in those eyes, the stance, the confidence of the stance, the beauty of the young man, and of course his nudity. He is naked. There's a penis, not covered up. You know, this is the 1400s. And this is this attempt at being secular. You don't see many paintings. You don't see many paintings at any era, with a male penis in them. Because that's too sexual for a Christian world to handle. It's far too sexual. We can sexualize women. That's okay. And a lot of paintings at the National Gallery depict sex or sexual or depict sensuality, but all from the perspective of female sexuality. There's no male sexuality. There's not a single painting in the entire gallery that I, you know, maybe somebody can challenge me on this, but I don't think there's a single painting in the entire gallery that deals with male sexuality. There's not a single painting in the entire gallery that depicts a penis in the entire museum. And there's very little in Western history, in Western art history. Now, there isn't sculpture. There isn't sculpture. But not in painting. But even in sculpture, it's very unusual. Usually, there's some cloth, there's some mechanism, there's some plant that happens to be growing next to the male penis to cover it up. And I think, well, so, you know, Alma says that's because women are beautiful. Well, yeah, I think that, but a lot of women think men are beautiful. And, you know, and there's absolutely no reason not to sculpt, paint male nudity. But it's almost never done. And I think that's because of very much the view of women during this period and the view of sex. Remember, and again, this is part of Western civilization, for which I think we are still suffering to this day. Sex is viewed as a negative. Sex is viewed as original sin, after all. The Virgin Mary has Jesus. She's a virgin. Why is she a virgin? Because Jesus cannot be born from sin. Sex is sinful. I mean, I'm not, you know, people are discussing Michelangelo's gayness and Da Vinci's gayness. You know, I don't know whether they were gay or not. I don't care. I find Michelangelo's life particularly interesting. He was probably gay, but I don't know. But what is fascinating is the arts, and that's what I focus on. And Michelangelo's certainly not gay. Michelangelo's the epitome. I mean, David is not gay. The epitome of, or there's nothing gay about it. It's the epitome of masculinity and strength and determination. And there's nothing gay or ungay about it. It's just a great man standing in front of you, and it's fantastic. But this view of sexuality as something negative, and then women going back to Eve in the Garden of Eden as seductresses, as tempting one with evil. And that is much the view historically of sex and of women. And it's why the way they are, why I think men, even to this day, get away with abusing women and sexually abusing them, because they seduce us. You know, we have no choice. We can't help ourselves. They are the essential about these, about women, about femininity, about sex, is woman as a seductress, woman as a temptor. And to depict male sexuality is now to depict it in a positive, because the male is associated with the positive, you know, and the female negative. The female is seduces Adam. She tricks Adam into eating the forbidden fruit, right? And that is still part of the way we treat women. It's still part of our attitude towards sex. It's certainly still part of our repressed attitude towards sexuality more broadly. And you see this in the paintings, and it's actually, again, fascinating to see that, you know. But during the Renaissance, you see very little, particularly in the early Renaissance, you see very little depiction of nudity at all in painting, even female nudity. Now that changes as you get into the late Renaissance and you go beyond the Renaissance into the 16th century. And certainly in the 16th century, you start seeing a lot of nudity, always in a particular context, always female nudity. But that's why Michelangelo's David stands out. Michelangelo's David is secular. It's Greek. It's not Christian. And you know, in Florence, they tried to destroy Michelangelo's David, and ultimately the people in Florence stand up and defend the David, and they defend the secular. But it goes in and out in terms of the church's willingness to tolerate this kind of secularization. And at the end of the day, Michelangelo is co-opted by the church to come and do religious stuff, right? The Sistine Chapel is magnificent, but Michelangelo didn't really want to paint it. Michelangelo didn't really want to paint it. It was the church imposing itself on Michelangelo, forcing him to do it. I mean, imagine what Michelangelo could have done with those years if he had done what he wanted to do. Imagine if Michelangelo lived during a capitalist era where he could sell his sculptures and live off of that. And when there was enough wealth in society where people would compete for his work. Instead, he was forced into creating a masterpiece. Granted, the Sistine Chapel. And I've been to the Sistine Chapel more than once. And I, you know, we once did a tour of the Sistine Chapel with very few people where it was empty. It was just unbelievable experience. Just, one of the great days of my life was, you know, you just stand there and stare. We tried to lie on the floor, but they wouldn't let us. But, you know, and just contemplate the ceiling. It's just gorgeous. But imagine all the secular work that our young Michelangelo would have done if he lived in a more secular era, given that he started his sculpture career with the David. And then his other great masterpiece. Again, one of the great sculptures of all time is the Pietà. You can look it up online, but it's Mary sitting there with four gowns, with Jesus, lying on her lap, dead, right? She's holding the dead Jesus. And while the story is religious, the sculpture is not religious at all. It is, again, a magnificent secular sculpture. Jesus is naked. He is strong. He's a powerful man. But what you have in the sculpture is a mother grieving for the loss of her child. A mother grieving for the loss of her son. Even though today the only way to see it is from a little bit of a distance behind glass, because about 20 or 30 years ago, somebody tried to destroy the sculpture by shooting at it in the Vatican. It's in the Vatican. It's still one of the great experiences, aesthetic experiences one can have. And if you want to really appreciate the Pietà, there are books with these beautiful black and white photographs of the Pietà that are definitely, and it shows all the different details in it. Since you can't get up close to see the details, it's a second best. And the books are, I have a book at home, and the book is phenomenal. So again, the Pietà is fundamentally a secular sculpture about a mother grieving for the loss of her child. There's nothing there. That is religious. If somebody's interested, just Google Michelangelo Pietà, Pieta, and you can find images of it. And particularly, again, look for the black and white images. I can't remember the name of the photographer, but he is spectacular in the photography. Yeah, I mean, one of my really favorite books, depicting the life of Michelangelo. And I love this book. I haven't read it in probably 20 or 30 years. But when I read it, what an experience. It really immersed me into the world of Michelangelo. It was The Agony and Ecstasy by Irving Stone. So I highly recommend it. Linda says that she's read it several times, and I'm jealous because I should read it again. I think I read it twice. Amazing book, The Agony and the Ecstasy by Irving Stone. So go find that book, download it on your Kindle or whatever, download it on your iPad, go read it. If you really want a good understanding of the world in which Michelangelo lived, a good understanding. Now it's a novel, so it's a novelized biography of Michelangelo, and I don't know to what extent it is accurate, but it is good. It is really good, and it really immerses you in that world. And it really, really, I'm a huge Michelangelo fan. And one of the things in the National Gallery is they have beginnings of paintings, incomplete paintings of Michelangelo that he did. Two of them side by side that he never finished. And again, even though they're not finished, you can look in a gallery and immediately my eye goes to them because there's something special. There's something unique about Michelangelo. First of all, he does the human body when he paints in truly three dimensionals. You can tell he's a sculptor. He's trying to pull them out of the canvas and make them alive, and then make them three dimensional. See, so the muscles, the shading, and then there's just a vibrancy to them. And then there's just the anatomy is so perfect. I don't know, he does this, I noticed that he did the throat of this one woman, and you can see all the, you know, all of this, all of the kind of where the Adam's apple, well, it was a man, I guess, the Adam's apple and the little wrinkles and the shading, just perfect. And it was, I don't think I'd ever seen those two. I've been to the National Gallery and maybe they weren't on display, or I don't know, but they were, maybe I've just forgotten, but they were truly, truly amazing. Truly amazing. Yeah. Daniel, you're ordering the book. Yeah. Everybody should be ordering this book. It's just so much fun. It's such a great, it's well written. I mean, he's not a great author, but it's just a, Michelangelo's life is just worth celebrating in a novel like that. Let's see. So you go through and then you know, again, so they're all religious stories in these paintings, almost all. Very, 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 even old, very little from the Old Testament. Almost all of it is from the New Testament. Almost all of it, something with Jesus or Mary or the saints, you know, the famous, the favorite saint, a painter to paint is, I forget his name, the one that gets all the arrows in him, because I guess there's drama there. You can present his sacrifice. You can present his face as calm because it's a, you know, he doesn't mind the suffering because he's sacrificing for God. And of course the arrows don't kill him. He's later, you know, this is the beauty of Christian saints. It's the goriest stories ever. So they try to, I guess it's the Romans. They try to kill him by, you know, shooting arrows into his body, and he doesn't die. So later they stone him to death, and that's how he dies. Wonderful stories. All right, then you go into the 16th century of 1500s, and now you're starting to see secular painting. And what's interesting here is the effects of globalization, and I'm globalism. You know, I'm a globalist, so you know I admire globalization. And here you're starting to see the influence of Northern Europe on Italy, and it seems, at least, that the Northern European artists, particularly from the area around Netherlands, parts of Germany, were painting secular themes, portraits, rich people, day-to-day life type stories, or stories from the Old Testament, or, of course, the big one is stories from mythology, Greek mythology. And at least with the portraiture and the day-to-day life, you start seeing the success of the Northern European painters, and they are now influencing Italy. Renaissance is primarily Italy. There's some impact in Germany. There's some painting going on in the north. But Italy is the center of the world, because the center of the world is Rome. The center of the world is the Catholic Church. That's where everything is happening. That's where the wealth is. That's where trade is. That's where everything is happening. But as we exit the Renaissance, Northern Europe is becoming richer and richer and richer, and becoming much more of the focal point, much more important than Italy. Italy is starting to decline over the 15th, 16th. Certainly once you get into the 18th and 19th century, Italy is not that important anymore, except if you love opera. And then of course, it becomes, again, the center of the universe in the 19th century with Rossini, Verdi, and Puccini, and a bunch of others. But in terms of painting, you can see that it's starting to drift northward. It's starting to drift towards the Netherlands, and ultimately to France and England in the 19th century. So even geographically, you're starting to see, where's the wealth? Where's the creativity? And where are the more secular societies? And clearly, Northern Europe, even back in the 16th century, in the 1500s, is more secular than Italy is. And I think it has to do with distance from Rome. And it also ultimately has to do with the Reformation and the rise of the Protestant religion, which I think allows for a more secular attitude, even though I don't think the founders of a Protestant church, Luther and Calvin, were very secular. They were awful, awful, awful religious nuts. But what you're seeing is that in the Protestant areas or the areas where the Protestants are fighting the Catholics, or just areas that are far away from Rome, you're seeing more and more secular art arising. And again, you start seeing more mixture. So yes, everybody's painting Jesus and Mary, and that's a theme that goes at least until the 18th, 19th century. But now you're seeing more and more and more, more and more and more mythology. You're seeing more nudity, female nudity, never male nudity, female. Male nudity only from the back, never from the female nudity. You're seeing more and more sensuality in the painting. Again, particularly if there's female nudity involved, very sensual. You're seeing more and more depictions of Cupid, more and more depictions of there's a painting in the National Gallery of which is quite stunning, and I forget from what period of time, but of Cupid kissing Venus, his mother. I think Venus is the mother. Quite sensual. And with all these characters around responding to this kiss, it's quite striking, quite sensual, and quite, you know, taboo, right? But you see artists experimenting with themes like that and pushing those kind of themes, and private collectors collecting those kind of themes. All aristocrats, of course, because they're the only people who can afford to have these paintings. And the church, of course, is now not the only entity that can afford art, not the only entity that can afford these paintings, because the economy of Europe is developing. More and more wealth is now being held in private hands, because there's more and more global trade. There's more and more rise of a not yet business, the beginnings of business, the beginnings of trade, the beginnings of banking, starting from Italy and spreading north to the Netherlands. There's a pretty open, free attitude in the Netherlands, although it's also, you don't see nudes, Rubens, you see Rubens, very, very sensual, but Rubens an exception. Most of the Dutch paintings are of day-to-day life, a little boring, day-to-day life, but beautiful lighting, beautiful depictions of people, you know, taking kind of normal people, day-to-day living, and elevating it to a level of beauty. That's what Vermeer does. I mean, so beautifully, using that amazing light that just gives you the sensation of, I want to be in that room. It's just this gorgeous light and people doing simple things, maybe playing the piano, maybe reading a letter, in a beautiful room, just calmness and just a beautiful sense of. A beautiful sense of the place. Alma says something about Bouguereau. We'll get to Bouguereau in a minute. Bouguereau is 19th century, of course. So you start getting this more, again, the more secular, the more interesting, the more applicable to our lives. Of course, a lot of stories from mythology that are very relevant. That have themes that are universal themes, a lot more sensuality, a lot more interest, and you can see the progression, and you can see the different areas in Europe responding differently, and you can see the focal center of the artistic world shifting from Italy, now going in the 17th century really to the Netherlands with Rubens and Rembrandt and the still lives, the beautiful still lives, of the 17th and 18th century, that are done in Holland and in other places in Northern Europe, just beautiful depictions of things that are just gorgeous, flowers and just arrays of stuff that wealthy people had, still lives is with nothing alive in them, so either food like lobster, fruit, exotic fruits, which were rare, which were something that the rich ate, beautiful silverware, beautiful instruments, sometimes of science. You start getting a sense of the richness of human life, or the potential richness of human life. You start seeing that in places like Amsterdam in the 17th to 18th century, because they're starting to gain wealth. They're starting to be free. They're starting to be free of religious authorities. They're starting to be secular, more and more secular. And this is Western civilization. This is what Western civilization means. They're starting to accumulate wealth. I mean, it is a relatively rich society, certainly relative to anything else going on in Europe at the time, and certainly relative to what it was 100 years earlier, not relative to what it would become in the 19th century. But this is the beginning. This is the beginning of trade. This is the beginning of philosophers really starting to think. This is Spinoza is in the 17th century is writing in the middle of the 17th century in Amsterdam, in the Netherlands. And Spinoza is the most secular of all of that era's philosophers. He was so secular that his books were banned. All his books were banned. You couldn't read Spinoza. You weren't allowed to read Spinoza. There was a whole underground of people sneaking his books around. And of course, he published most of his books, I think, under a pseudonym or anonymously. And they would be shuffled around underground. You know, and the intellectuals and some of the aristocrats and the people who were interested in philosophy were reading them. And almost all the important philosophers that came after him read Spinoza. And he was incredibly, incredibly influential. But of course, they couldn't admit to reading Spinoza, and they couldn't cite Spinoza, because that would have been heresy. So religion, even in the 17th century, even in the 18th century, is still a powerful force. And you can see that again in the paintings. You can see that as you travel across the different art from the different eras. It's great. It's a great experience. And then you get to the 18th century. And you get the 18th century, and the center of focus is clearly now shifted to France. France is now really the center of the artistic world. And you see painters like Fragonard or Le Brun, the first woman painter of real significance that you start seeing her paintings on the wall. And you see what you see in these paintings is sunlight and beautiful people and joy and people having a good time and merriment and just beauty, right? And this period, you know, you start seeing the Italians are still there, particularly in Venice. You see beautiful landscapes images of Venice. Some of the most beautiful paintings I know are these images of the Venetian canals and the Venetian buildings, just gorgeous. But you're not seeing those religious elements anymore. Religion is now sidetracked. The paintings have all shifted. The paintings are now almost all secular, depicting either mythology or events going on in the world at the time, or just day-to-day life. Heroes, struggles, challenges. And there's a real shift. And while the painters are not necessarily any better qua painters than they were in the Renaissance, the stories, the themes have completely shifted, have completely changed. And there's more vibrancy, more life, more positivity, more optimism. Right? So you see that in beginning in the 18th century. You also see through the 17th and 18th century creative uses of light. I mentioned Vermeer, the other Flemish painters, but you also see it. You also start seeing it in France. You see it in Caravaggio, one of my favorite painters, Caravaggio from Italy. In the creation of drama and lighting and darkness and light. You see it in Rembrandt as well. And they're exploring, they're developing, they're broadening the toolkit, they're broadening the language of painting throughout this period. And they've got the freedom to do it because they're not being hindered by religion. They're not being hindered by religious authority. Again, religion is an anti-force in Western civilization, not a pro-civilizing force. It's the anti-force. It's civilization advances as they resist, as they move away from religion. Doron mentions Artemisia Gentileschi, something like that, as a female Renaissance painter. Yes. And there's a movie about her. I can't remember the. I think it's called Artemisia, but it was a good movie. And I think she had to hide herself for much of her career. She had to hide the fact that she was a female. That the painting she had the paintings were assumed to be by a male, because then they would have not. Otherwise, they would have not been accepted. So it's very difficult for women to paint, and you don't see many women painters throughout. You know, even the 19th century, there are very few female painters. I mean, Virginie Lebrun in the 18th century, and I'm trying to think of female painters in the 19th century. Not many. Or sculptors. How many female sculptors are there? Were there? I mean, there was one of Rodin's mistresses. I forget her name. She was a fantastic. Oh my God. Her name's on the tip of my tongue. Anyway, somebody I'm sure on the chats will remind me of her name. But she was a fantastic sculptress in the late 19th century, early 20th century. But very few women are allowed to do arts, just like very few women were allowed to do science, were allowed to read, were allowed to study, were allowed to get educated. And this relates again to this whole view coming from religion about female and sexuality and seductresses and not fully, and this comes from Aristotle even, not fully having reason and therefore not to be trusted and not to be educated. And then you get to the 19th century. The 19th century, which I think has some of the greatest masterpieces, some of the greatest artists in all art history, both in the world of sculpture. Some of my favorite sculptures are from the 19th century, Scandinavia and France, particularly France, but even England. Frederick Leighton, one of my favorite painters, was also a very good sculptor. Some magnificent works of art. And of course, now in the National Gallery, there are very few of those paintings. There's a few, so you can get a sense of them. And actually, I should mention this painting, one of my favorites, certainly in the National Gallery. So one of the things that always ooks me is that during the 19th century, the late 18th century and the 19th century, there are almost no depictions of the Industrial Revolution, no depictions of the Scientific Revolution, no depictions of the grandeur and the change. I mean, the only art we have of the 19th century of the Industrial Revolution is like Dickens, the pathetic misery of child labor and working in the factories. And yet this was an era that changed human history. It's an era that created all the wealth that to some extent that we still enjoy today. This was a magnificent, amazing era, right? And there's one artist, English artist, who actually does paint the Industrial Revolution and paints the Scientific Revolution, which is fascinating. And his name is Wright of Derby, that's his name. And he's got a painting in the National Gallery. It's hard to find his paintings. And he's got a painting in the National Gallery, a big painting, a massive painting. And it depicts an experiment. It's a scientist showing a family an experiment about oxygen and about air. And what he's doing is he's got a bird in a glass container, and he is sucking the air out of the glass, and the bird is going to die because of the vacuum, because she has nothing to breathe. And it's very dramatically lit, and the primary light is on the children, who are kind of horrified by the fact that the bird is dying. But you've got a variety of different characters standing around, and it's basically a celebration, in spite of the horror on the children's faces, of science, of experimentation. Yeah, the actual title of the painting is An Experiment on a Bird in the Air Pump. And it's dramatic, it's beautiful, and he has a number of these. He has a number of paintings of different experiments and people's response to those experiments, and a celebration in the early 19th century, late 18th century, of kind of science. And he also have depictions of factories, very beautiful depictions of factories, like with the glowing light and very, 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 very beautiful. So Wright of Derby, you can find some of his paintings online and you can get a sense of his stuff from there. All right, I'm going to wrap it up here quickly. We've gone for over an hour already with my thoughts on art. And I'll answer the one... the one super chat question in a minute, but I'm trying to avoid politics today, but what can you do? Alma's asking, what are you, I mean, I wish you'd, you should, Alma, you should really use Super Chat to ask these questions, because then the people who ask the questions that I answer them in Super Chat, you know, it's kind of not fair if I'm answering a free question. But I'll just respond. He's asking about the depiction of the creation of Adam, Michelangelo's painting, where God is bringing life to Adam, and they don't touch because it's a magnificent painting. I love that painting. It's beautiful. God is very real. He's very human. You can interpret it in a variety of different ways. You can interpret it as not just God creating man, but also, you know, the providing life, creating life, creating value, creating, giving another human being something spiritually. It's a huge, beautiful painting. Okay, I've got another super chat question, which I'll get to in a little bit. Let me just wrap this up. And then you go, and then, you know, the 19th century is my favorite. Now, the 19th century is not represented in the National Gallery. To really appreciate the 19th century art, the Pre-Raphaelites and academics in England and in France, the academics in France, they're my favorite paintings, whether it's Bouguereau, Leighton, Alma Tadema, the Pre-Raphaelites. You have to go to the Tate, Britain, which is a magnificent museum and has some marvelous sculpture and great paintings and hundreds of them, and really beautiful. But there's a little bit of that in National Gallery. And then you go to the Impressionists. And what you see is the beginning of the decay of Western civilization. The blurriness, the boring. I find the Impressionists boring mostly. And granted, the National Gallery doesn't have the better Impressionists, the better paintings by the Impressionists. It doesn't have some of the more vibrant, alive paintings that Renoir and people like that painted. But for example, almost everybody at the National Gallery was hanging around the Van Goghs, the two or three Van Goghs there. I mean, really, they're not even the very good Van Goghs. They're boring. They're monochromatic, you know, like Sunflower. I mean, why is that so beautiful? Why is that so amazing? It's boring as hell. It's not particularly pretty. And then there's a painting of a chair in a room. Yeah, it's kind of weird, but it's not. Doesn't say anything, doesn't mean anything, doesn't convey anything. So the blurriness, the lack of focus, but mainly just boring. It's day-to-day life, but day-to-day life blew it away. It's not like the day-to-day life of the Dutch, which is interesting, and you want to peer in, you want to look in, you want to be in that room. Here you don't want to be involved. And, you know, I mean, Monet's lilies, okay, I've seen it once. Okay, nice. All right. Again and again and again and again, the same grayness, the same lack of color, the same lack of excitement. So, you know, not particularly interesting. And then you go from there, of course, to the moderns. Now, the moderns you can't see, luckily, but even with the Impressionists, you can see the deterioration in no anatomy, the lack of anatomy, the purposeful distortion, Picasso then completely distorting the visual universe, completely distorting the world out there. And then, of course, if you cross the river and you go to the Tate Modern, you can see the complete disintegration of what is called art, and the complete disintegration of the conceptual mind, complete disintegration of the human spirit and the human mind, of human reality. So non-art of so-called modern art. And there you have it. There you have the rise of Western civilization as depicted in art through the Renaissance, into the, you know, the 16th, 17th, 18th, and then the pinnacle, in a sense, of the 18th and 19th centuries. And then it's collapse. And really, if you wanted to put a date to the collapse of Western civilization in many respects, in certainly in the arts, but also I think in philosophy and in many, many, many respects, it's the World War I. It's the breakout of World War I. It's 1914. And from then, you see a collapse, you see a bounce back up a little bit through the 1920s, and then massive collapse in World War II, and then again, a bounce up and then slow decay and decay and decay. So very slow decay. But there's no art today. There's just no art today. Certainly not in the visual arts. There's no painting, there's no sculpture. I mean, I'm not saying there's none, because there's still people who do good stuff. And, you know, I bought some paintings and sculptures from contemporary artists that are beautiful. But in the mainstream, in what the intellectuals consider art, in quotes, there is no worthwhile anything going on. What's worthwhile is in the fringes. So Western civilization, qua Western civilization, is not producing anything of value, and has produced very little of value since 1914. Very little art in the heartland, in the heart of Western civilization, what the critics and the intellectuals consider the good art, whether it's in literature, the exception is Ayn Rand, whether it's in sculpture, there is no exception. Again, among those, whether it's in painting, there is no exception. Cappelletti was there, and you've got some good pieces today, some good artists working today, but they're not in what's considered Western civilization. They're the French. You know, Anna Huntington, it's mentioned, but she was in the early 20th century. She's pre this collapse. And yeah, and she does good art. She doesn't do great art. Anna Huntington is, I don't think, is a great sculptor. She's good. I enjoy her work, but she's not on the scale of the 19th century sculptors in France, not on the scale of the 19th century sculptors even in Denmark. Or in England. So, I mean, generally, America is a second rate when it comes to art. America comes into its own artistic wise in the 20th century when there is no art. So it has the most famous 20th century artist. I don't know, what's his name? Andy Warhol, right? But that's non-art. Talk about boring. Ugh. So there you have it. A quick sketch of the history of Western art, at least modern Western art, and from the pre-Renaissance to today. It's quick, but again, I encourage you to go to the National Gallery and do this, or go to any museum in any major European city. But although I would go to the American museums as well, because Americans got rich in the 20th century and in the 19th century and 20th century, and then started buying a lot of art from Europe. So a lot of the great masterpieces, particularly of 19th century art, actually in the United States. So I love the museum in Cincinnati. It has some amazing pieces. And I've talked before about the museum in Puerto Rico that had some amazing pieces from the 19th century. One of my favorite Frederick Leighton paintings, some great pre-Raphaelites, two Bouguereaus in Puerto Rico. Go figure. Two Bouguereaus. So some wonderful paintings. You know, the 19th century is underrepresented in the National Gallery, but go to Tate Britain. All right, I hope you enjoyed that. It's a little unusual, not a typical You're on Brooke show. We didn't talk politics, we didn't talk philosophy per se, but I think it's important if you want to understand what Western civilization is. It's to understand the scope, to understand the art, to understand what happened, and to understand how, to what extent the secularization of the West is what made the West. That transition from pre-Renaissance, which is completely dominated by religion, to the Renaissance, where it's starting to be secularized in style, if not in content, to the 16th century and onwards, where now the content is becoming secularized, to the 19th century, where pretty much all of art is completely 100% secularized, post-Enlightenment. And that's the West, right? The great literary achievement of the Renaissance is Dante, Zinferno, religious. Compare that to the great literary achievements of the 19th century. Victor Hugo, completely secular. Those are my thoughts. Sorry, there were no super chat questions on that. That would have been nice, but so be it. All right, here's a political question. What's the best argument against people that want to regulate social media because of election interference? And is data collection inherently bad? What's the best argument against people? I mean, the best argument. Social media doesn't interfere in elections. You know, false news, fake news, all of that. You have to respect the intelligence of the voters. You have to respect the fact that voters, even though a lot of them won't, will figure out what's fake and what's not. It's not the responsibility. The social media is not a newspaper. They're not out to try to tell you the truth. They're not reporting. They're just a platform in which people post stuff. And some of the stuff they post is nonsense. Some of the stuff they post is funny. Some of the stuff they post is cat videos. Some of the stuff they post is fake news. Some of the stuff they post is good news, is real news. I don't think social media should spend too much effort in trying to figure out what is what. I think the efforts that they engage in today in trying to figure out what is getting them into trouble. But I'm not worried about election interference in that sense. I worry if we start seeing hacking of the machines, if we start seeing people pay people to vote. But if people are just trying to misinform, propagandize, then, you know, deal with it. Then the way to deal with it is to provide true information. And of course, now, it is worrisome, and it is something to be done, if a foreign power like Russia is funding it, if a foreign government is funding it. But then it's a foreign policy issue. The U.S. government needs to intervene and tell the Russians to take a hike and to stop doing this, which the American government has tried to do a little bit of, but not forcefully and not righteously. I have no problem with data collection as long as you know, as long as it's not done fraudulently, which sometimes it is, and sometimes, you know, these platforms use it in ways that it's not intended to. But I think part of it is that we're in a new field and the law around it and the what's acceptable and what's not acceptable around it is still being formed, and people are all trying to figure that out. So there's nothing inherently bad about data collection. And then finally, there's this question. Big fan sometime. I would love to hear you talk about what John Galt would do with for those not capable of joining our economic society. I see the moral and objectivist arguments, but I'm still not clear on that. Why are you worried about them? I mean, so I believe that there are very, very few people who cannot join our economic society, well, less than 1%. People who are born with some real debilitating disease or with brain damage or whatever, people get into an accident and can't join. But most people, even people with low IQ, can do something productive in a capitalist economy. And again, I wouldn't use today's society as an example because today's society is not capitalist. So you're only getting a fraction of the available jobs that would exist in a capitalist society. And I don't believe the story that robots are going to take all the jobs. There's always going to be jobs where you want the human touch and jobs we can't even imagine and jobs we can't even perceive. But, you know, I would like massage to get so cheap that I can take them, travel with a masseuse with me to give me a massage every day. And the day will come, well, that'll be incredibly cheap and you'll be able to do that. And we'll be so rich that we'll be able to do that. And there'll be somebody who wants to give massages and it doesn't require immense, necessarily doesn't require immense intelligence to be a masseuse, but it does require other skills, you know, and a passion for it. So, I mean, there are all kinds of things that can imagine people doing for you that I think even people who are not going to be computer scientists can do. So I don't buy that. So there's very few people who really can't join our economic society. And then the question, what happened to them? Well, there are a number of options. Their family takes care of them. And I think if you have a child who is not capable of taking care of himself, it is your responsibility to take care of them as a parent. You brought the child into the world. It's your responsibility, at least until they are capable of taking care of themselves. And if they're born with some disability that makes it impossible for them to take care of itself, it's your responsibility to take care of them, whether you do it in your house, whether you put them in an institution, whether you hire somebody to take care of them. It's your financial responsibility to take care of them. Now, let's say the parents are too poor and they can't take care of them. Again, I don't think that's going to be much of a problem in a capitalist society, because in a capitalist society, we'll all be pretty wealthy. So I don't think there are going to be that many people who are so poor who can't take care of their child. But I don't know, lightning hits and the parents die or they are indeed poor, too poor to take care of this child. then charities will have to take care of him, and it will be dependent on charity. And then it's a question of if you want to contribute to those charities. And I think most of us want to contribute to charities like that. We don't want to think about human beings suffering to the point of not being able to survive and potentially dying. So I think most of us would contribute. I don't think it would cost a lot. I don't think you'd have to contribute a lot. I think it would be quite cheap to do that. So, you know, I don't see it as a problem. I really don't see it. And it troubles me that it's such an important issue for people. Like, to me, it's like people take care of themselves. It's not hard. And if people really can't take care of themselves, then their family will take care of them. The friends of the family will take care of them. And if none of that works, charities will take care of them. In the 19th century, where we were relatively poor, there was no welfare state. And I'm not going to say nobody died in the streets, but very few people died in the streets. And people who couldn't take care of themselves were taken care of by charity. So, and that's an era when we were relatively poor. We're today in an era where we're relatively rich. And where the cost of helping somebody just survive, you know, just have the food they need, have a dwelling, a place to live, is dirt cheap. I mean, they don't have to live in London, so nobody like this should live in London because they can't afford it. So they should live somewhere else, but that's fine. So, because they can't afford London, the charity can't afford to keep them in London. So I don't see the problem. I just don't see the problem. And I don't see it as an issue. And I don't see it as something that we need to, I mean, we need to talk about it because people are concerned about it. But the fact that they're concerned about it is part of the problem, I think, that we face, that we're too oriented towards altruism and towards the idea that there's a problem, that A, that people are incompetent, and B, that it's our moral responsibility to take care of them. I have no question in my mind that they will be taken care of. Well, yeah, so somebody says there are lots of homeless people and I don't see charity helping them. Well, actually, charity is helping them, massively helping them. They're huge charities, soup kitchens, shelters for the homeless, free housing for the homeless, tons and tons and tons of charity that are trying to help the homeless. But I would say a number of things. One is, why are they homeless people? And to a large extent, they're homeless people because of the mixed economy and because of government policies. And why is the charity ineffectual? And the charity is ineffectual because it has no standards, and because we live in a mixed economy, and because there are not enough jobs being created, and because most of the charity is being provided by government ineffectually and inefficiently. So yeah, there are lots of homeless people today, but we don't live in capitalism, and we're not selfish. If we were selfish, if we were self-interested, and we lived under capitalism, there would be very few homeless people. I'll give you a quick example, and then I'm going to stop. In Los Angeles, there's huge numbers of homeless people. And the Los Angeles city government has decided that they're going to build housing for the homeless people. And they keep building housing for the homeless people and putting them in these free homes. They give them to the homeless people for free. And yet, there are more and more homeless people all the time. And they don't understand this. We're giving you homes. Why are there still homeless people? And the reason is that, you know, everybody in the country knows that Los Angeles is giving homeless people free homes. Everybody around the country is moving to Los Angeles to become homeless because they'll get a free home. It's not that hard. Not that hard. All right. But look, the homeless problem is caused by housing regulations and housing controls. It's caused by a mixed economy. It's caused by altruism because we're psychologically destroying our children. We're psychologically destroying generations of people who can't take care of themselves, who can't think for themselves, who can't take care of themselves, who can't get a job, who expect to be taken care of and then they can't. We're creating mental health diseases all over the place because we destroy people's self-esteem and so on. So homelessness and poverty today are not a reflection of capitalism, but the reflection of altruism and a mixed economy. And that is it. I'm done because I've already gone an hour and a half, and I thought today's show would only be like 40 minutes because how much can I talk about art and Western civilization shit for? But it turns out one thing I can do in life is talk. All right. Thanks, everybody. Really appreciate your time. Appreciate your attention. Hope you enjoyed the show. I hope Hope I didn't bore you and that you had a good time. Don't forget to share. Don't forget to subscribe on YouTube. And hey, enjoy what's left of the weekend. Enjoy the rest of the week. And I need to run because I've got to be somewhere at 7 o'clock. And I will see you all, I'm sure, next time I run the show.